Hello and welcome to HFMA Talk, the podcast for NHS finance and health professionals. I'm Charlie Spicer, Policy and Research Executive at HFMA. In today's episode, we'll be focusing on all things environmental sustainability and the role of integrated care systems, how they can drive the agenda forward, healthcare impacts, and what finance staff can do. I'm really excited to be joined by our two guests for this episode. Firstly, Alexis Percival, Environmental and Sustainability Manager at Yorkshire Ambulance Service and Climate Change Lead at Humber Coast and Vale Health and Care Partnership. And our second guest, Dr. Artie Bansal, GP, founder of the Greener Practice Network and Net Zero GP Lead at Humber Coast and Vale Health and Care Partnership. So thank you both very much for joining us today. And in this conversation, I think our audience will be really interested in hearing about your journey, what you've been doing locally, and how and why you both became involved in this journey. So I'd like to hand over to Alexis and Artie to begin this episode.
Hi, Charlie. Hi, Artie. So I'm Alexis Percival. As Charlie introduced, I'm the Environmental and Sustainability Manager at Yorkshire Ambulance Service. And my journey has been quite a long one since I was about the age of six. I kind of realised quite early on in my life the impact that humans have on the world. And I suppose I suffered quite an early onset of climate anxiety at quite a young age. And most of my life has been dedicated to working through the variety of different impacts of climate change in various different guises, from ecology and biodiversity through to changing and amending a lot of the estate's facilities, various bits and pieces. In my current job role, I've got two hats at the moment. So I'm the Environmental and Sustainability Manager with YAS, but also I'm the Net Zero Lead for the Humber Coast and Vale ICS. And both are interlinked in many ways, because as any trust across the whole of the UK knows, that we have to have green plans in place and a strategy at the moment in order to get to net zero in line with the Greener NHS Agenda of 2045. So my kind of role with the ambulance service is interlinked directly with the ICS, because we can't work in isolation. And in order to achieve that, all of us have to kind of work collaboratively. So there's a lot of really fantastic stuff that is going to happen. And there's been quite a lot of stuff that has already happened within across the entire country in every ICS. So there's a lot of different bits and pieces that we can cover in this session, just to kind of talk through what's coming, what we need to look at, what finance needs to be stumped up in order to afford it, but also what finance can be saved through a lot of stuff. But also the benefits that come from tackling climate change and tackling sustainability head on, which is huge, huge benefits. I'll pass over to you, Artie. You can give us a bit of an intro as to your journey.
Yeah, so my journey maybe didn't start quite as early as yours, Alexis. What I remember is sort of being in sixth form college just in the early 90s and being really worried about the Amazon rainforest, learning about, you know, forests being the lungs of the world. I obviously subsequently learned that the oceans are also the lungs of the world, but I was actually quite terrified. I was like, oh my God, we're cutting so many football pitches at every, you know, few minutes. And it was scary. But at one point, I remember at that time thinking, should I do environmental science rather than medicine? I did go into medicine. And I sort of stayed aware of sustainability, but didn't really get that involved in a active way until just before the Paris climate talks. And when I started reading the science again, I had my proper climate anxiety moment then, because I hadn't fully understood the urgency of tackling the climate crisis until about 2013, 2014. I didn't realise that we had a very short window of time to actually really limit emissions, and that if we didn't do it quickly, then we would pass all of these tipping points, at which point then human intervention becomes a moot point because the natural systems might take over. So it just felt then that this is the one thing overarching that, you know, everybody needs to work on. And I just kind of felt like I needed to get involved. So wasn't much happening at that point in primary care, at least in general practice. Most people were thinking of of climate action very much in terms of estates and energy, not really in terms of the core clinical work that we do. And so really my work from 2017 onwards has been trying to get people to recognize that, just as Alexis said, there are huge benefits to, you know, acting on the climate crisis. It's really such a win-win. And in particularly in the health sector, it's a huge win for health, for people. And it's absolutely essential that we do it. But it's also, you know, potentially beneficial. Well, definitely beneficial from a financial point of view as well.
So for you, Artie, I mean, you've done a lot of stuff with Greener Practice and the Green Practice Network and working through GPs. What has been the kind of the lows and the highs of the program, the journey to kind of getting people on board? I mean, is there still a mountain to climb in order to get people engaged with this agenda?
It feels like the door is opening a little bit now, and people, it's starting to become a bit more of a mainstream conversation. So I remember about 5 or 6 years ago when I was having a conversation about the climate crisis, people would kind of almost want to change the conversation. They'd want to change the topic of conversation, or they'd make an assumption about the fact that you were talking about something quite peripheral to their core job. Whereas I think now at least people are recognizing that they do need to talk about it, but I think there's still a huge misunderstanding within the health sector generally that this is absolutely central to everything that we do. I think people still see it as something to tick off on the periphery of what they do generally in the health service, and they don't recognize really how you know, this really impacts on every aspect of our health and life. And in some ways, I find it's slightly still frustrating that people will talk very passionately about things like integrated care or reducing health inequalities or social prescribing or important person-centered medicine, and haven't at all linked any of those things into, you know, being greener and, you know, how those things actually tackle the climate crisis and are our road to net zero. So I feel like the connections aren't being made yet. So the public is aware that we have a climate crisis. The public is aware that we need to act, but they haven't worked out what that means for them in their workspace, I don't think. So yeah, that's still a mountain to climb. What do you think, Alexis?
Yeah, I mean, for me on my journey, it's been a very lonely 12, 13 years in sustainability, but the advent of Fridays for Futures and the uprising of children going, you adults need to pay attention, you need to do the action and you need to invest in this. It for me, back in when all that started happening around 2017-18-ish, there was a deluge. It was a huge amount of the NHS that suddenly understood the impact. I mean, if you look at some statistics, we've got 1.3 million people that work in the NHS. We've got about 3 million in health and social care. So we have a huge chunk of the population that can influence not just healthcare, but the health of the climate and the health of the country and the health of the rest of the world. Because what's certainly become apparent through this pandemic is how much of an impact we have in the NHS on the entire world economy.
Also, this sort of just recognizing the wider determinants of health, you know, so we have through the pandemic recognized that, you know, viruses don't recognize borders. Well, the climate crisis doesn't recognize borders either. And the social determinants of health that people have recognized, I think, in the health community for a while, we really need to broaden that out and talk about the planetary determinants of health. You know, we're all fundamentally dependent on our planet for health and life, for our well-being. And again, I think that's a connection that hasn't fully been made yet, but I hope that we start to see ourselves as part of nature and as part of the planet, and not really separate from it.
I suppose one of the things that we've got to recognise is that every consequence of things that we decide and choose now will have a long-term effect. And okay, let's take the simple face mask. Everybody has used simple face masks all the way through this pandemic. Within my trust, we used 20,000 face masks a year in the lead up to pandemic. First 3 months of the pandemic, we used 1.3 million. In the entire pandemic, for the entire NHS, we've used 2.9 billion, 2.9 billion face masks. And when you start going, well, actually, you know, that's only the 3.5 grams and it's only 20p. 20p times nearly 3 billion is an astronomical cost. And that's one item of PPE. So when you start looking at the impacts of climate change, those are shipped halfway across the world. So we've got shipping, we've got oil, we've got, they're made out of plastic, which is made out of oil. So you start looking, that's a contributionary factor into the climate change, because we are, the products we're using as a single use item will have that direct impact. And the longer term impacts of these things, decisions we're making now. So there are alternatives to single use face masks. We've got reusables. And that impact will dramatically cut the carbon footprint. It'll also, longer term, dramatically reduce the cost. And it will dramatically increase the capability of the NHS to bounce with the resilience that we need to have within the system for all of these types of impacts we're looking at. Some statistics on another level. 5 million people will experience flooding by 2080. I think it'd probably be around that in the next 3 or 4 years. In the UK alone, as of this week, over 1 million people had their electricity cut off. So, and that was due to flooding. And I'm looking out the window now, I've got flooding just up the road from where I am. It's snowing. And I'm thinking, well, what is going on? You know, some elements of climate versus weather. But when we're starting to look at things like this, natural disasters, for example, in 2018, some big facts from World Economic Forum. 11,800 deaths were contributed to climate change, and 68.5 million people were displaced by climatic impacts. Many of those were in Africa and India and Bangladesh, but that caused $132 billion worth of damage. Is that sustainable year on year? Because it's increasing. Those natural disasters are increasing year on year. Heat waves, a nice NHS figure. Heat wave of 2003 cost the NHS £41 million. And the wider economy, nearly £400 million. That's one heat wave in 1 year. And heat wave being 5 days, 10 days on the trot.
Yeah.
We're going to have those more frequently every year. So the impact on the NHS is going to be dire, and it will it'll not just come from heat. It'll come from droughts. It'll come from wet weather through flooding, storms. And this year, along with all the previous years, has been a fine example of all of that. It's not just, we're not going to sit in isolation. We've got 7% of our estate that's located in floodplains alongside of sea inundation. And our region that RT and I work in is the highest risk. Within this century, Hull, Selby, North Lincolnshire will be between 1 metre and 3 metres below sea level. And then when you're looking at other places around the coastline, Norfolk, the similar type of elements. So we've got large chunks of our country that we're going to end up with either people staying belligerently under the water, building big barriers, or moving. So the impact is going to change, and the health system's impact is going to change around the country. It's not just the direct impact of flooding, this weather anxiety that comes with it, which is climate anxiety. There's lots of other things that will have a different change in the system, and who needs consulting, who needs to deal with the injuries, and then the longer term impacts of things like an increase in tropical diseases that'll hit the UK. And it's not a case of we can sidestep this. This is already,
happening. All of those things that you're talking about, because climate change is already happening. We've already got over 1 degree rise. So we're seeing the impact of more moist air, more water in the air, which is causing all the flooding, drier soils, you know, the impact of food production. We're seeing all of that now. And I think people do recognise, don't they, from life experience, that prevention is better than cure, and prevention is a lot cheaper than cure. So I was going to ask you, Alexis, in your sort of, when you first talked about face masks, and because I know you've been involved in that at a very high level and at a national level, what did you find were the barriers to getting people to understand that actually it was better for them to think about investing in the reusable, sustainable face mask rather than the potentially at, in the short term, cheaper, but polluting, expensive, carbon costly, single use?
So, I mean, there's the economic impact. So it more or less, the cost the same. The finance is one barrier, because at the present moment in time, the whole of the NHS has still got free PPE. So it doesn't just go with face masks. It goes with curtains and plastic aprons and plastic gowns. But if we can start to shift and pilot these various projects, we can see what the economic benefit could be, and kind of start to factor in other beneficial elements. But the barriers, I mean, there's the obvious infection prevention control, the IPC barrier, which it's been an education journey on that front. Looking at things like finance and understanding, and I think for many, it's actually understanding where we need to go. So the Greener NHS journey hasn't reached everybody in our organisations yet. We need to continue banging on that door and telling everybody, do you know what, by 2030, you can't buy a product from any supplier in the entire world, if you're in the NHS, unless they have a strategy to get to net zero and a green plan. And they're looking at their route to get their products to a green situation. So there's a lot of barriers that we need to overcome. And it might just be somebody who needs a conversation about it to understand that journey. In some ways, you know, we're still in the middle of a pandemic, so there's not very much finance floating around in the system. So it's understandable. But at the same time, we need to kind of start doing the right thing now.
Do you think it's also that we're not really considering population health when we talk about costs? So, you know, it really surprised me a few years ago when I learned that every year in this country, 36,000 people are dying prematurely because of the impact of air pollution. Now, in the early days of the pandemic, we hadn't hit those figures, but we'd completely transformed society in order to prevent the deaths from coronavirus. But we aren't at all making any fuss, or haven't until recently been making any fuss about the regular deaths that we're having from air pollution. We're not making a fuss about all of the deaths that people have every year from fuel poverty, because they can't afford to heat their homes and they're more likely to get respiratory illnesses. You know, we don't really think about the fact that nature has so many beneficial effects for us in terms of our physical health, our mental health, our immune system, but actually a lack of access to that is potentially causing people chronic illness, or maybe not being able to be physically active, not have the opportunities to be physically active, or not have the opportunities to have a healthy, sustainable diet. You know, what is the cost of all of that to population health? But also, if we did all of those things for population health, we would prevent a lot of ill health. We would reduce the costs on the NHS. That sort of medium, long-term thinking, which needs to be at the heart of sustainable healthcare thinking, isn't really part of any kind of process, is it? I mean, I wonder how we bring that in.
Yeah, I think, I mean, we know how much it costs to transfer somebody to hospital or for a GP visit or a consultant's time. We also know how much it costs for somebody on their palliative care route to death, but we also know how much it costs the NHS for them to die. So there's a lot of elements are in there, but the cheapest and always the most essential bit is that first bit, that social prescribing, getting somebody out walking, enjoying nature, being somewhere completely different that actually can cure a lot of the other stuff upstream. And I think it's a bit of a, maybe we need to look at every single patient in a full life cycle analysis and say, okay, on their scenario planning, how much would it cost for them to have these various interventions? And therefore, you'd instantaneously know, okay, they're going to go and have surgery. Could that be preventable by having education at maybe the age of 10, 12-ish? And could we invest in that? The problem is, along with the same lines as climate change, it's unseen. because you don't know the consequences for several centuries or 10 to 20 years type of thing. So I think there's many different elements that we do need to factor in. And you're right, it's the changes in models of care. This is kind of what we're looking at through the ICS programs with the green plans, is kind of trying to look at that model population health and how we can change that when we're up against the other wall of climate change, and how we can help prevent a lot of those things. They're intertwined.
Absolutely. In so many ways. I mean, the thing that I found really helpful in trying to get people who might sort of categorize green and sustainable from a sort of personal carbon footprint perspective and not really be able to translate that into the clinical or the healthcare perspective, the thing that helps me is a model that was described by Frances Mortimer from the Center of Sustainable Healthcare. So this is looking at the clinical aspect of healthcare, and she says there are two ways to make things more sustainable. You can either reduce the need for healthcare, or you can increase the efficiency of healthcare. And reducing the need for healthcare is about preventing the need for healthcare in the first place. So that's all of those prevention type activities, health creation type activities, community-based assets and things like that. And the other side is, you know, empowering patients. So one of the things that's changed, I think, in the last 50 to 70 years and why the NHS needs transformation, and hopefully one of the things that if we do this well at ICS level, can be supported by the way that the ICSs are set up, is really thinking about how do we improve long-term condition care, because that wasn't what the NHS was set up for 70 years ago. The NHS was set up to deal with acute episodic illness. But actually, most of the people that we see now in the NHS are living with long-term conditions. And we need to change how we support them to leave the best lives that they can leave. But the way that we do that is almost always going to align with a lower carbon way of doing it, because it's going to focus on preventing ill health, and it's going to focus on empowering patients to self-manage their healthcare, so therefore reducing the need for healthcare. But we also, as you said, Alexis, you know, in terms of looking at things like end-of-life care planning, frailty, integrated care for complex patients, you know, we need to think about how do we increase the effectiveness of the healthcare? What should our models of healthcare be? Do we need to change the way we deliver healthcare? Should we be bringing a lot of the services that currently exist in the hospitals out into the community? And I think we're at a position now where we can have some really transformational thinking, I think, to deliver the kind of healthcare that will actually improve, you know, patient and population health.
We've got quite a prescriptive route within our green plan to look at primary care and secondary care, but also the wider impact across the entire region, and kind of getting everybody on the same page and on the journey, really, aren't we? And it's quite a powerful document that I'm hoping the ICS will help drive through, because we cannot fail on this. This is an agenda that we have to get on board. But also what needs to be a key priority, I think, for everybody in the NHS is it's embedded. So if we took the Marks and Spencer's model of plan A, because there is no planet B, and we basically said, OK, your job, your finance, your procurement, you need to have embedded in your job description sustainability. And it doesn't even need to be named as green technology, green whatever. It's basically you need to go for the best product, irrelevant of cost. And that is one thing that we need to look at now, as well as it's looking at a better model for finance as well. That we buy the best product for the best lifespan and the best impact for patient care. Because the reality is a lot of these products we use that are single use have only come in for basically, you know, maybe two, three CJD cases or MRSA cases or things historically that happened 30 years ago. And we've spent billions and built a whole health economy around lots of single use products. But also we've got a lot of models of care that are based around something that happened 30 or 40 years ago that need to change, that financially are not correct either. So I think if we can collaboratively look at a kind of digital twinning system that runs through all of our healthcare system, so as a patient going on their journey, where can we cut a lot of the, I won't say red tape, but cut a lot of the inefficiencies and come up with alternatives that actually make their journey better or their journey not necessary, because we intervene at the beginning. And that takes a lot of collaboration through the entire system. Hopefully our kind of ICS vision will kind of push that one, but it's a difficult one to mandate when everybody has their own financial controls in systems, really.
And what do you kind of think that the role of the ICS is in this, in terms of embedding this and driving it forward? How do you think, you know, from your experience or just in general, how do you think the ICS is different and how that can drive the agenda forward in terms of embedding sustainability within day to day?
My kind of experience within our region is that it's a lot more collaborative work that's going on. And the conversations happening with those that haven't been involved in sustainability agenda before. So we're talking to finance directors, estate directors, chief executives who, yeah, I've kind of got it. You know, it's a tick box exercise. We've got a green plan in our trust. But the ICS unifies everybody, and it's also going to mandate, because they'll become a statutory body, it'll be a mandatory thing across the board that it has to happen. But it's also get embedded in lots of different routes, like NHS standard contract, the NHS planning guidance, and various other legislative and guidance documents that we have to do these things. So there is an understanding that it needs to happen, and the ICS can help facilitate that. But also the ICS is getting funding from different routes. So if there's a challenge and there's different things that we can look to identify that help accelerate the journey, which Arti's got some fantastic projects that are going on that actually, yeah, they will improve human health, but they'll also have a massive cut in the financial budget within the whole region. And in doing that, you know, that can be invested in different things, but the ICS can help facilitate funding to go around differently within the area. I think, can help streamline a lot of the processes, but also by mandating everybody has exactly the same thing in place, we all can be comparative. Whereas now we're just kind of going, well, I've done this, I've done that, but we don't know what the outcomes are. So if we all have to do things like having a renewable energy contract, have a green plan, have a net zero lead, and then there's going to be more and more things that come on regionally in the next year or so that we have to mandate and we have to do, we all have to do it in line with each other.
I think the other thing is that ICS is the basic premise for the ICS is to drive improvements in population health and to reduce health inequalities. And the other thing is that they're supposed to work across the NHS, the local authorities, the community sector, the voluntary sector. And it's supposed to be collaborative. So rather than these sectors working in isolation, it's supposed to bring all the interested parties together and say, actually, let's look at this holistically. What's actually going to make a difference for people's health and well-being? So if that's done well, and it always depends on how it's actually implemented, but if it's done well, the whole premise of the ICS will hopefully support, actually bringing sustainability into the agenda. Because as I've said, better population health and, you know, reducing the carbon impact of healthcare are almost entirely aligned. You know, they just work together. So it's such a win-win. And then, of course, as you improve people's health, you also reduce the costs. I mean, I think I was just trying to sort of go back to one of the questions that was coming up in my mind as Alexis was talking earlier. The other thing that perhaps we need to sort of think about is, yeah, so actually this is the thing that I was thinking about. It's when Alexis was talking about how do we embed it into the system. Absolutely, carbon needs to trump cost. It becomes a bit of a ridiculous narrative when we almost start to talk about this as if we have a choice. We don't have a choice. We absolutely have to dramatically transform society so that we can, you know, reduce the carbon impact of everything that we're doing, the carbon, you know, that we use. But that doesn't necessarily mean a bad, you know, a bad life for us. That's potentially better life for us. You know, that's potentially living in a sustainable way is potentially something positive for our health and our well-being and our happiness, because all the things that we need to make life more sustainable are also going to make us better in terms of health and well-being. And I guess the other thing to say is that actually we think about some of these benefits coming to us in the longer term. One of the big advantages for us in the healthcare sector, although I'm not sure we've got the message across yet fully, is that the benefits in terms of health and in terms of cost reductions are immediate because they're the same actions. So when we reduce, for instance, you know, the travel carbon, so we reduce the number of vehicles on the road, we reduce external air pollution, we immediately get the benefits of reduced respiratory infections, fewer people ending up in hospital with acute asthma attacks. So, you know, we can see the impact of air pollution on so many things. And that's just one condition, you know, respiratory, cardiac, you know, mental health, brain health, dementia, the health of maternal health, so pregnancy related morbidities, all sorts of things. And that impact will happen immediately. So, you know, that we need to find ways of considering these benefits, these huge co-benefits, into the decision making that happens as to where we put the investment. And I think the other thing is that we need to recognize that change is going to need investment, and preventative health is going to need investment. It's going to need investment across different sectors, and allow for that lead time. I think so much of the way that, although I don't really understand it very well, but so much of the way that the NHS seems to be run is just to keep the current system going. So it's not really set up to think about how would we do this if we were starting afresh. And we need some of that thinking now as we move into the ICSs.
I mean, the problem we've got in the transition to net zero is that, as you quite rightly say, it will require investment, and it will require quite a lot of investment. All the way through my career, I've had to do return on investment packages to look at everything and go, OK, well, this is going to cost 200,000. How long is it going to take to recoup that? In reality, you know, replacing a light bulb shouldn't have to have a return on investment. It should just be that's what we're doing. But when you start looking at the impacts of changing a light bulb from one of the old ones of the 1990s to one of the modern LEDs, you can save 70% of your electricity costs if somebody leaves the light on. There's an education program that goes with that, as in turn the light off. So it's how can we go from reduction to elimination in many different ways. But with things like, for example, the transition we've got with ambulances to zero emission vehicles, it's not going to be cheap. But also we need a much bigger vision. And this is where the ICS will help kind of join everybody together, because I need every single health trust to get on board and putting in the right sized charging point for electricity, but also working with councils to put in hydrogen. And having that much bigger vision across a region is where the ICSs come in as kind of being collaborative on that. But the cost won't be built. Borne by the ambulance service, it will be borne by the ICS region. And nationally, you know, as Arti quite rightly said, we will actually reduce dramatically. We drive, just in Yorkshire alone, we drive around 45 million miles a year with diesel vehicles that are polluting the patients that we're helping save and rescue. So it is something that, if we can make that transition, it's gonna sting straight off on anything we invest in. But the benefits, as Arti says, we reap them very quickly. But it's how we make a business case for all of that. But do we need to make a business case?
I was asked to make a business case for improved asthma care, which is also lower carbon. And I was thinking, well, I can count the cost of the switch in, say, the higher carbon footprint inhalers to the lower carbon footprint inhalers, and I can give you a figure on that. How do I give you a figure on, if we improve asthma care, the number of people who won't go to hospital? That's a harder calculation to do. And okay, that calculation can still be done. What about children not missing education and the impact that that has on their future opportunities? Or the fact that when you've got better asthma control, you do better physical activity, so that's going to keep you healthier for a much longer period of time. It's probably going to reduce your cancers, your chances of stroke and heart attacks. How do I calculate that, you know? and that cost isn't necessarily going to, you know, that benefit isn't going to come straight away. So I think, you know, having a bigger vision and not having in some ways to say, I need to show you that you get a return on investment for this in the next 2 years, because all the financial planning is so short term, but that we should be doing this because this is the right thing to do. I think there needs to be something of that built in. But I was also reading that, you know, I was quite surprised that the UK Climate Change Committee estimated that delivering net zero costs 1% of UK GDP. It's not an awful lot, really, is it? You know, that is not a lot of our funds, just 1% of UK GDP. And then there was another economic study, I think it was the Vivid Economic Study, which calculated that actually that investment delivered economic co-benefits of 4.5% GDP. So that's another thing that perhaps people aren't taking into consideration, that this transition to a greener economy potentially brings us huge amounts of benefit and gives us, as you mentioned before, Alexis, the resilience that we need. Because some of these changes are happening, some of what needs to happen will be adaptation to climate impacts that are already happening. But if we invest now, then we're going to have a more resilient society, resilient economy that can kind of survive the shocks that we're going to have in the next sort of 20 to 30 years.
And that's the key element. It's the shock. If we don't do it now, that it's 1% GDP now, whereas it will increase dramatically as we have to kind of adapt rapidly to various things. The Ukraine crisis is a really big impact on our gas prices, and the NHS is going to suffer horrendously because a lot of us have got it tied in. Talking to a colleague the other day, of saying, you know, I bought my gas prices at 40p. It's at the moment it's trading at £1.50, £1.60. If I come off the tariff now, where am I going to find that money from? So there is a lot of shocks that will come to the system. That's not just from the climate adaptation, but that will play a major role in a lot of these things. I've got a question for you, Artie, and maybe Charlie can kind of help shape this one. If you were to give 3 golden nuggets of advice to a finance team as to what they need to embed into their structure in order to make a more green, sustainable finance structure as such, what would you do? What would you advise them to do?
Gosh, that's a difficult question.
Shall I start on that one?
Yeah.
My 3 kind of golden nuggets, it kind of covers some of the stuff that you've got, which is, let's get sustainable impact assessments in there. So a RAG rating. So a business case comes to you. You want to know whether it's better, same, or worse. So let's take a product, an MRI scanner, for example. Is it more efficient, greener? Yeah, it's got a green RAG rating versus it's less efficient and it's got a red rating. Notice I didn't mention the cost of it at all. It's literally physically the whole lifespan. Is it going to take more energy to kind of run and to look at? Is it a greener product or the rest of stuff? So an SIA, I think, should be essential, and it's going to be embedded in our green plan that should go in all business cases. As you kind of mentioned, we need to have carbon versus cost. That should be, you know, it trumps it straight off, and it's something that is going to come through in a lot of the procurement stuff. So all the PPN notices that have gone out as of April 2022, it has to go in. There has to be a social value and sustainability weighting in every single procurement tender that goes out. And in having that, you've suddenly shifted it away from cost as well. But it gets down to an individual product. So are you going to go with the product that's going to sit in landfill for the next 400 years? Or are you going to go for a product that can be reused, put back into a circular economy, and that product isn't waste and doesn't, it's not exactly rotting away all the plastic stuff we've got in landfill, but it doesn't go there. There's also the additional benefits that go with that, because you're not having to pay clinical waste contracts and disposal costs and various things.
I was going to say the same thing. I think just in addition to that, you've kind of mentioned it already, but just sort of having a broader understanding of costs and benefits. So looking across, like you said, the whole life cycle of a product, but also looking across the whole life cycle of a patient's journey when you're making decisions about what you're going to invest in and what you're not going to invest in. So I think we need a longer term perspective when it comes to what is actually more costly, because often the things, a great example with the PPE earlier, often the things that are cheaper in the short term are actually way more expensive in the long term, and not just financially, but to our ability to survive and live. So and I think the other thing is maybe looking at community impacts and putting in costing and benefits, but the potential benefits for all of this, having some really good health economic sort of analysis go into these kind of decisions, so that we can look at those kind of wider issues that I mentioned before, like the impact on education, the impact on physical activity. We can think about those kind of things. And I think the only other thing that I would say is, I think everybody, because perhaps we haven't mentioned this enough, one of the barriers that we said earlier on was trying to get people to understand what sustainability is about, you know, having the lens to understand it, having a framework to think about it. And so I think we need to make sure that everyone's, as some people are calling, carbon literate, you know, so people actually do understand the impact on a global level, but then what it means for them in their particular sector and how they can take positive action. And I think I think that's kind of an urgent thing that needs to happen right now, that everybody needs to be carbon literate in order for us to actually make this transition.
I totally agree with what you said earlier, Arti, which is that carbon must trump costs. But I think perhaps a few of the finance directors or finance staff listening to this may still find that quite difficult, even when cost reduction could be immediate. So what is one piece of advice you'd give listeners to take away from this conversation? And have you seen any examples of this in your ICS on how to get your finance staff involved and really engage with this green agenda?
I think one thing that's kind of been highlighted with this end of year rush that we've had this year is that climate change doesn't sit in financial years. And the investment for climate change doesn't sit within that timescale either. And the Salix funding challenges that we've all had across the UK have kind of highlighted that real issue that we should step out of this one-year realm. We need longer-term investment in a lot of these products and a lot of these ideas and a lot of the change that we've got. So, yeah, a return on investment for any type of investment that we're looking at shouldn't just be set to 5 years. Some of them, you know, looking at solar panels or ground source heat pumps, it could be 10, 20, even 30 years. But the benefits to the, as Arti was saying, the benefits to the wider society, we need to step away from a year-on-year financial realm. I don't know how we do that. And that might be something we can help facilitate with the ICS. We just need to put that idea in place, really.
Yeah, and I think I would agree with that. I think the kind of change that we're talking about is complex change and it's transformational change. So some of the changes are going to be easier to implement, say maybe the buildings or the energy estate changes. There's still complexity there, but some of them will be a little bit easier for us to see how we're going to get there. When it comes to clinical healthcare and changing how we deliver healthcare to our population, that's a very complex change, but it's an important change and it's something that we really have to think about. So I think we need to make the investments now in order to see the impacts in the future. And we do need to change the way that we can finance these things, because otherwise, if we're always looking at a year-on-year process, we're only ever going to be able to tinker at the edges, and that's not what we need, you know, for in our lifetimes or in our children's lifetime. This, you know, this action has to happen this decade.
That was fascinating. I've got one last question for you both, which is hopefully thought-provoking for the people listening. And that is, do you feel pessimistic or optimistic about the future of reaching net zero within the health service?
That's a good question. I think probably Alexis and I go up and down in how we feel about this, depending on our interactions. I have to say, for myself, I'm more optimistic now than I was 12 months ago. And I feel like a lot of people are now at least on board with the idea of it, even if they don't, they haven't fully got their head around it. And I feel like more and more will happen and things will start to accelerate. I think for people in this sphere, sometimes because you kind of been, I'd say this is probably truer of Alexis than it is of me, but if you've been on the leading edge of something, you feel like everyone is always kind of playing slightly catch up. And even if you're on the leading edge, that's not fast enough or quick enough or enough. So that can lead to pessimism. But in terms of looking back and thinking, where were we a year ago, 5 years ago, it does feel like things are moving in the right direction.
For me, I'm positive today. As Arti says, it's something that changes on a daily basis. And I think if we were to do a climate change red tape challenge within the NHS, we'd highlight a lot of the bureaucracy that's holding us back from a lot of the change that need to happen. But the other thing is there's some stuff that we just can't tackle or change now. So we have to have a bit of a target. I mean, within our region, we're looking at 2035 for decarbonising. Other regions around the north are looking at 2038. Nobody's looking at 2045, but we need all finance directors on board in order to get there, because they've got to help us. We've got to all go through this agenda. As a kind of general climate change stuff, I think it's been a fascinating journey in the past few years. And to quote Professor Van Tam, I've been on the bus by myself, and there is a party going on the bus now. And it basically, we're all on the journey together, but there's still more people we need to get on board. And we need the finance teams to back us through this process, because you know, you can't just sit on a pile of money in the middle of the ocean. You have to physically invest to make the change to stop what essentially is a kind of creeping cancer across the planet.
Yeah, it might be a good way to sort of say we can't eat money. At the end of the day, this is what we're heading for. If the climate crisis is allowed to unfold unmitigated, then we'll be in a situation where our children were saying, did you think we could eat money? Because we can't.
Yeah.
Thank you both so much for joining us this episode and taking the time to share your stories. I'm sure we can agree that this topic would be one we could discuss for hours. And I'm sure that this will have inspired some of our listeners as they embark on their own journey. Thank you for listening to HFMA Talk. Don't forget to subscribe to our channel on your preferred listening platform so that you don't miss any of our future episodes.